You're listening to the RBN Energy Blogcast. This is an audio version of RBN's Daily Energy Blog, which is a fun and informative daily commentary on oil, gas, NGL, and renewable markets. Each morning, we cover commodity fundamentals and industry changes to keep you informed of developing trends across the energy landscape.
Sunday, August 22, 2021. Blank Space, Part 2. The Ins and Outs of Natural Gas Storage. Published by Housley Carr. The volume of natural gas in storage and the flow of gas into and out of it are among the most closely watched indicators in the U.S. gas market. That makes sense, given that these numbers provide important weekly insights into the supply-demand balance, gas price trends, the impact of LNG exports, and any number of other market drivers. However, what's often ignored by those not involved in the day-to-day physical gas market are the mechanics and economics of storage itself. Who uses gas storage, and for what purposes? What are the value drivers for a storage facility? Why are there different types of gas storage contracts? How much does storage cost? And what do storage rates reflect? Today, we explore these and other questions. As we said in Part 1, in the decades leading up to the early 2000s, the U.S. gas market underwent a series of fundamental changes, each spurring the development of new storage capacity. First, starting in the 1910s, 20s, and 30s, a number of depleted gas reservoirs were converted to storage facilities, initially in the Northeast, but then in other regions. In the late 1940s and 50s, another approach, aquifer storage, was introduced as an option for regions, primarily the Midwest, that needed gas storage capacity, but lacked a sufficient number of depleted gas fields. Aquifer storage had an advantage over depleted reservoir storage, namely that gas can typically be injected into and withdrawn from it more quickly. However, a disadvantage of aquifer storage is that it needs to be completely empty at the end of the heating season each year, or it can lose gas. The primary purpose of both types of storage facilities was, and is, to help balance seasonal swings in gas demand. In the 1990s, the gas market was turned on its head with the issuance of FERC Order 636, along with its predecessor rulemakings going back to Order 436, which among a whole range of market transformations had huge implications for gas storage. Until then, gas pipeline companies were the primary buyers and sellers of natural gas. That's right, they were transporting gas and marketing it all at once. And they and a number of local distribution companies were the ones who paid for the development of most gas storage facilities. Those pipelines then delivered gas to gas distribution companies and electric generators, along with other customers, and the infrastructure cost was baked into bundled regulated pipeline rates as state regulators or FERC saw fair, generally defined as just and reasonable. With Order 636, interstate pipeline companies were prohibited from buying the gas they deliver, taking the cost of gas out of pipeline rates and leaving just transportation and storage rates to be regulated under the basic bread-and-butter cost-of-service model. Pipelines kept most of their storage, but it became a separate regulated service for them, with some storage allocated to the transmission side of their businesses for balancing. For storage that pipelines did spin off, and for the developers of new storage, the Energy Policy Act of 2005 provided that if a storage owner could show lack of market power, its rates could be market-based. With access to most gas storage capacity now open, gas traders and marketers became increasingly involved in putting gas into storage at cheap summer prices and removing it in winter when prices are usually higher, thereby capturing storage's intrinsic value. With the creation of the gas futures market in the 1990s, traded volume soared and the natural gas paper market, including NYMEX Henry Hub futures, quickly became very liquid. Traders also sought to capture the volatility spread of gas price movements, and to capture the price swings, traders needed readily available natural gas from their stocks. It doesn't happen often, but over the past 15 years, about one-third of the time average winter gas prices have actually been lower than the previous summer's average prices, which can result in gas storage traders losing their shirts if they haven't properly hedged. Something else was roiling gas markets in the early 2000s, the belief that the U.S. was running out of natural gas and would soon have to rely on LNG imports. The need to be able to manage large inbound shipments of LNG and stage it for delivery spurred the development of a lot of Gulf Coast storage capacity, more specifically, salt dome storage that can handle rapid injections and withdrawals of gas. Big-time LNG imports never happened, of course, so the salt dome gas storage capacity developed to support imports instead was put to an alternative use. Gas stored in salt domes enabled traders to quickly respond to price changes in the market with physical gas, and the intraday price spreads became a money-making venture. Traders could capture storage's extrinsic value. All that background will help as we discuss today's topic, the ins and outs of gas storage's economics and mechanics. As we said earlier, the primary use for U.S. gas storage is to balance seasonal swings in demand. Secondary, but still important, uses include 1. Supporting the hourly flexibility required by the rapid growth of gas-fired power generation. 2. Managing the flow of gas to LNG export terminals. And 3. Serving as a sort of insurance against unforeseen supply disruptions. There are two basic types, base load facilities and peak load facilities. Base load facilities are capable of holding enough natural gas to satisfy long-term seasonal demand requirements. Typically, the turnover rate for gas in these facilities is a year. Gas is generally injected during the summer, non-heating season, which usually runs from April through October, and withdrawn during the winter, heating season, which usually runs from November through March. These reservoirs, many of them depleted reservoir facilities in the Northeast and Midwest, are larger in terms of the quantity of gas stored, but their delivery rates are relatively low, meaning the gas that can be extracted each day is limited. Refer back to Part 1 where we discussed ratchets. Instead, these facilities provide a prolonged, steady supply of natural gas during the withdrawal period. Aquifer storage provides somewhat more flexibility. Although these facilities have typically been expected to proceed in stately fashion from filling in the summer to withdrawing in the winter, the substantial impact of gas-fired power generation in the market has led to a number of them being enhanced to allow for year-round injection or withdrawal. It's important to remember, though, that in both depleted reservoir and aquifer storage, gas is pumped into porous rocks, not giant underground caverns. As a result, these types of storage can't turn on a dime. Typically, once they've begun injecting gas, they'll be injecting for a period of time, and when they flip to withdrawals, they'll withdraw a substantial portion of their working gas before flipping back. Peak load storage facilities, in turn, are designed to provide high deliverability rates for short periods of time, meaning natural gas can be withdrawn from storage quickly when the need arises. Peak load storage typically cannot hold as much gas as base load facilities, however, it can have turnover rates as short as a few days or weeks. Salt caverns are far and away the most common type of peak load storage facility, although, as we said, some aquifers can provide at least some peak period gas, as can, to a much smaller extent, above-ground storage. Many participants in the U.S. gas market use gas storage to some degree. Pipeline companies use storage for operational purposes, that is, to help manage the flow of gas to end users. On the downstream side, local distribution companies, or LDCs, power generators, industrial customers, LNG exporters, and other gas customers use storage to help maintain appropriate flows to them, while marketers, traders, and financial institutions use storage to provide gas marketing services and optimization for their network. It is noteworthy that when storage is operationally part of a pipeline system, the storage services typically do not involve injecting specific quantities into a specific field for a customer. They involve delivering some gas to the pipeline at some point on its system and getting gas back at that point later on. How the pipeline accomplishes that, whether the gas physically comes out of storage, diversity of flows, or out of line pack, is usually left up to the pipeline. Some pipelines also offer a higher priced service known as no notice, under which storage and transmission capacity are bundled together to allow a customer such as an LDC to take gas as it is needed, with no specific nomination of deliveries, that is, no formal request to transport X amount of gas from point A to point B. This service was created to replicate the reliability and responsiveness of the pipeline's old bundled merchant service. The value of any specific gas storage facility is tied to a number of factors, chief ones being its location and connectivity. Storage is particularly valuable when it is located at or near 1. And market demand, 2. The confluence of several pipelines, and 3. An important trading or pricing hub. Timing matters too. Storage has more value during periods of contango, when the future value of the gas exceeds its current price. Further, when supply and or demand growth results in a midstream constraint, thereby giving storage an enhanced role in system balancing, its value increases. The type of facility, depleted reservoir aquifer, or salt cavern, also is a significant value determinant, with storage offering higher injection and withdrawal rates typically being of more value than those that can only cycle gas in and out once a year. There are many types of contracts, including long-term and short-term storage agreements and everything in between, park and loan deals, and swing deals. Term storage provides dedicated storage space with a fixed term, i.e., a start and end date to the storage option, within which the customer can manage the injection and withdrawal periods subject to the facility's requirements, which are enumerated in the contract's terms. The customer typically pays a fixed monthly demand fee over the term of the contract for its reserved capacity. On top of that, the customer pays a variable commodity fee based on the amount of gas it injects or withdraws. Lastly, term contracts specify a fuel cost, which is gas that the facility keeps to make up for compressor fuel and losses. Short-term agreements operate very similarly to their longer-term brethren, except, you know, with shorter terms, less than a year, usually with more streamlined contract provisions. Similar in function to short-term and interruptible storage contracts are park and loan deals, which provide a customer with the flexibility to inject gas to be withdrawn later, park, or to withdraw borrowed gas from the provider and return it later, loan. Park and loan services may not be specifically identified with any particular storage facility, and it's usually left up to the operator as to how the park or loan is to be physically accomplished. So customers in park and loan deals can borrow gas without having an inventory of gas in any facility. Rates under park and loan contracts are set in pipeline tariffs and usually exceed those of term contracts, but like any pipeline service, can be negotiated or discounted if there is agreement with the pipeline or operator. Again, there are other types of storage agreements, too many to cover in detail here. Market-based storage contract rates, as opposed to pipeline cost of service rates, are typically set to reflect the intrinsic value of the seasonal spread less the variable fees and the cost of capacity, with the intrinsic value generally quantified by the average forward curve seasonal price differential for some future period. As of Tuesday, August 16, the spread on the forward curve between the average 2022 injection season price, April through October, $3.30 per million BTU, and the average 2022 to 2023 withdrawal season price, November through March, $3.46 per million BTU, was a paltry 16 cents per million BTU, or $3.46 minus $3.30. Over the next 5 years, that spread grows to 35 cents per million BTU and averages 29 cents per million BTU over that time frame. So storage lessees looking to secure capacity for that time frame would want to pay some rate plus fees that equates to less than 29 cents per million BTU per year, or about 2 cents per month. As we said earlier, higher cycle rates as might be offered at salt cavern and aquifer storage can add additional value for commercial lessees looking to capture extrinsic value, which is derived from the inherent volatility within the market. That's just a primer. There's obviously a lot more to the economic and mechanics of natural gas storage, and we'll discuss more of them in detail in upcoming blogs. In the next installment, though, we'll analyze the adequacy of current gas storage capacity to cope with peak winter demand, the impact of increasing LNG demand, and what that might entail for future storage buildouts. Blank Space was written by Taylor Smith, Max Martin, and Shellback, and appears as the second song on Swift's fifth studio album, 1989. Recorded at MXM in Stockholm and Conway Recording in Los Angeles, the Max Martin and Shellback produced single was released in November 2014. It went to number one on the Billboard Hot 100 Singles, Adult Contemporary, Adult Top 40, and Mainstream Top 40 Singles charts. It has been certified 8X Platinum by the Recording Industry Association of America, or RIA. The song was inspired by 1980s synth pop and satirizes Swift's history of romantic associations with high-profile celebrities. Personnel on the record were Taylor Swift on lead and backing vocals, Max Martin on keyboards and programming, and Shellback on guitars, bass, keyboards, percussion, and programming. 1989 was recorded in 2013-14 at Conway Recording in Los Angeles, Jungle City Studios and Lammy's House in New York City, MXM in Stockholm, Sweden, Pain in the Art in Nashville, and Elevator Nobody in Gothenburg, Sweden. Produced by Max Martin, Taylor Swift, Jack Antonoff, Nathan Chapman, Imogen Heap, Mattman, and Robin Shellback, Ryan Tedder, and Noel Zancanella. The album was released in October 2014. It went to number one on the Billboard Top 200 Albums chart and has been certified 9 times platinum by the RIAA. 7 singles were released from the LP. Taylor Swift is an American singer, songwriter, and record producer. She has sold over 200 million records worldwide, making her one of the best-selling music artists of all time. She has released 9 studio albums, 3 live albums, 2 compilation albums, 15 EPs, and 57 singles. Swift has won 8 Academy of Country Music Awards, 32 American Music Awards, 29 Billboard Music Awards, 2 Brit Awards, 12 Country Music Association Awards, 11 Grammy Awards, and 11 MTV Video Music Awards. She continues to record and looks forward to the day she can tour again.
Thanks for listening to the RBN Daily Energy Blogcast. For more information on energy market reports, maps, and consulting engagements, please visit us at rbnenergy.com. And thanks for rocking with us.